Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, a very good, beautiful Saturday morning out there. A little chilly if you're in the hill country. Could believe it was 41 degrees when I left home outside of Bernie and 57 or something like that when I got into San Antonio. So you're waking up to a beautiful day. Hope you saw some of that beautiful full moon last night. It was just spectacular out there. And tell you what, looks like the next week or 10 days or so going to be an absolutely beautiful stretch of weather. Great for gardening. We still need to see some rain in the forecast, which isn't out there right now, but it's beginning to look a lot like spring, even though we're just winding down to the end of February. But so much to do and so much to talk about, and that's what we're here for. We're gonna talk to AJ first, but this is what I call the smart people's half hour. Don't have to do any commercial breaks till the top of the hour, and it gives us time to maybe explore a little more in depth questions you might have, or if there's something special you want to ask about, or if you just want to get your call in early before those phone lines get jammed up. Anyway, give me a call. You know the number. 210-599-5555. And because I hate to keep people waiting, let's see what AJ is up to this morning. Do we have any situations developing this morning, AJ?
We just developed what I was mentioning to you. You said I may have to call back on a second half hour because I don't fit into that category.
Oh, I would disagree with you there. You're very much up there in the smart people category.
Hey, Bobby, on planting these portulaca seeds in the spring, you said to wait till the ground warms up and then water. But like the seeds that I planted in pots, they're already mm-hmm. coming up from the wintertime, so why couldn't I put those seeds in there now and get them started in the garden, or still wait till it warms up some more?
And what kind of plant are we talking, AJ?
Portulaca.
Portulaca, okay.
Portulaca, okay.
They will grow faster in the pot, simply because the soil is going to be warmer in the pot. You can keep them a little warmer. You still need to keep them real good and sunny. But there's nothing wrong with planting them in the garden now if you want to do that. Since they're coming up in the pots, you're going to have a very delicate root system, or you're going to have to plant very carefully. But they'll grow a little faster for you in the pots. You can watch, you can control the moisture in the soil a little bit more easily. But if you've got busy days coming up ahead, you just want to get them in the ground and not have to tend to them quite so much, you can plant them today if you'd like.
All right. Next question on those roses, taking those cuttings. What size of a diameter of a cutting do you is best used?
Probably around half the size of a pencil. If you took an old wooden pencil, you and I are both old enough to remember when that's what we wrote with all the time. But that's about the ideal size. Tips of the branches are going to root most quickly. If they have any buds or blooms on them, go ahead and cut those off. Strip off the lower leaf or two, make your cuttings about 3 or 4 inches long. And then I've kind of gotten away from using these rooting powders. They just don't have much in them. I think you're better off to soak your cuttings, make a mixture of seaweed and water or a little bit of garret juice and water. Soak your cuttings for 15 to 30 minutes in that, then put them in your perlite. Keep them warm, keep them bright. And you should have a very high percentage of those cuttings root for you.
Well, I've done that. You know, I set them in that liquid seaweed and then put them in perlite, and then I water them every morning with a sprinkle can because that water goes right through there.
Right.
And so I'm going to see how that works. Now, I'll call you back when I got growth on them and ask what I need to do next to get them out of that perlite. So I'll
okay.
save that call for later.
All right. Well, listen and remember that you don't have to really limit your watering. If you were a commercial grower and had a commercial growing set up, you'd have those cuttings up in on a bench where little misters came on about 15 times a day just to kind of keep the humidity up. And rooting cuttings in perlite, you never really have to worry about keeping them too wet as long as your container drains, because, you know, water is not what not what hurts anything. I mean, if somebody stuck your head in a bucket of water for 10 minutes, it's not the water that'd kill you. It's the lack of oxygen. And I hope you don't have any family members who would consider that, but I might. But anyway, the problem with keeping soil too wet, with keeping plants too wet, is that the water drives all the oxygen out of the soil, and it's not really the water that does the damage. It's a lack of oxygen. Now, when you're in that perlite with your cuttings, that stuff is so loose and open, there's never a problem of oxygen depletion. So you might water them 2, 3, 4 times a day if you're around home to do it. That'll just get them, that'll be sure they don't dry out. And rose cuttings, it's very, very critical that the cuttings don't dry out. After a month or 6 weeks, kind of lift up gently on the stem. If you feel resistance, you've got some roots started. And at that point, you can give me a call and we'll talk about what the next steps are. But it's going to be a great day. I'm sorry.
We don't want to boggle this mine here any more than we have to, Bobby.
Well, early mornings people are not getting up quite as early as you and I have to on Saturday morning. So again, that's why I love this time when people call with questions that sometimes take a little longer to discuss. So anything else I can help you with this morning?
That's it, Bob. I done run out, and you have a good day and stay out of trouble, okay?
The good day I plan to have, trouble just sort of seems to follow me around a little bit every now and then, but I have an idea that you're a gentleman that is well acquainted with that style of life, so just get out and make the most of it, and don't get in any trouble that you can avoid.
Okay, Bobby. Thank you.
You're sure welcome. Thank you. Goodbye. All right, looks like we've got Clint waiting to talk. Good morning, Clint.
Good morning. How's it going?
It's just rocking along. It is an absolutely beautiful morning out there. Big old moon going down, and it's going to be a beautiful day.
Yeah, I saw that last night and felt like howling at it like a werewolf.
It was pretty.
It was mighty pretty.
And it's just, you know, getting in to be a beautiful time of year. I'm not going to guarantee we're beyond another little cold snap or two, but Easter's early this year, and hopefully we'll move on into more spring-like weather, and hopefully the rains will continue. I love the temperatures, but I sure don't like looking 10 days out and not seeing more than a 10% chance of rain. We need some follow-up moisture.
I definitely need a couple more inches. I got like 7.3 finally after those 2 weeks, and it's gone, soaked up real good, and still needing more, but I was happy to get that.
Amen to that one. But, you know, we've had enough to put a little water in the creeks. Guadalupe's running for the first time in a year and a half or so, but we're sure not getting much water back down into the aquifers, and a lot of the smaller streams are just barely struggling along. So we need a bunch more of it out there, but this is Texas. Either it will or it won't.
Pretty much. I finally got my soil test back, and I guess I overdid the sulfur a tad too much. So how do I bring back down my pH?
What do they show as your pH?
Almost 8, 7.99.
Okay. Well, your sulfur is what will bring the pH down. 8 is not bad, but 8 is slightly alkaline. The lower the number, the more acidic it is. And so I wouldn't tell you to do a thing. A pH of 8 is not bad. 7 is neutral. And, you know, throughout a lot of the hill country, you know, we're looking at pHs that are 8.5, 9, sometimes even above. The, it's been a long time since I had math, and I did okay in it, but I never liked it. But remember that the pH is what we call a logarithmic scale, that 8 is 10 times higher than 7, 9 is 10 times more alkaline than 8, 10 is 10 times more alkaline than 9. So you wouldn't really want to go... you wouldn't really want to let it get a whole lot higher than that. But sulfur very slowly is converted to sulfuric acid, and that's what will bring the pH down, which will make it more acidic. So you didn't overdo it. If anything, you might have underdone it a little bit. But that acidifying action doesn't happen overnight. So at pH 8, I'm not going to worry too much. pH of 8 is a pretty good growing medium if you're not trying to grow blueberries or azaleas or some of those things that don't really like South Texas to begin with.
I don't know how accurate the internet was, but a lot of the trees out there really kind of want a maximum of 7, like the avocados.
Well, you know, there's ideal and then there's best we can do. Ideally, yeah, most... what happens when you make the soil more acidic, it tends to make the nutrients, help the nutrients go into solution a little bit better and makes them more widely available to the plants. That's the principal effect of lowering the pH, is simply increasing nutrient availability, especially on metallic elements and things like that. If you want to knock the pH down, you could always get a little bit of phosphoric acid. You don't want to use hydrochloric. You don't want to use nitric acid. They're just a little bit too strong. But phosphoric acid is present in a lot of household cleaners, and you could always do that. But my theory is, and my experience is, that pH really isn't all that important. It's kind of what you have in the soil and how you get to that lower pH. I mean, the more organic material you have in the soil, the lower the pH is going to drop. And you're, of course, down in an area of very poor soil. So, and that's what you've been trying to do and doing very well with your compost tea and all. You've been building organic material. And when you have organic material, you naturally have humic acids, fulvic acids. These are Mother Nature's natural soil acidifier. So if anything, gosh, I'd probably get some humic acid, get with Medina and get some liquid humic acids, or liquid humates as they call them, and that's going to knock the pH down a little bit, but more than that, it's going to really work on freeing up the nutrients. Again, pH is just a number. And unless you're growing something that is highly acid demanding, I wouldn't worry too much about it. Your avocado should be fine at pH 8, but if you want to add anything, get some humic acids. That's going to be the natural way to make them a little bit more acidic, and, you know, just give the microbes the boost they need. And the nice thing about the sulfur now, it's going to suppress the bad fungi. Unfortunately, it suppresses the good fungi as well. But I think we've had, you know, some problems with fungal problems with the roots of the avocados. And not just you, but a lot of people have. And the sulfur is very definitely going to help you with that. So I don't feel like you've overdone. Don't feel like you've done anything wrong. But if you want to do one more thing to help lower the pH, to help make it more acidic, humic acids would be the way to go, and Medina has a couple of great products that can do that for you.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the humic acid and stuff. I was thinking better to do that than some of the household chemicals you were talking about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, humic acid, it's what Mother Nature makes. I mean, that's what is, as your compost breaks down, humic acid is released, and, you know, I a few years ago thought, oh, humic acid, I'll go to the dictionary and look it up and see what the formula is. And I asked that question of Dr. Lane Ingham when we went out up to Austin and took one of her courses. And she said, well, which one? She said there are about 100,000 different humic acids. So it's not any one particular chemical structure, but it's a huge array of naturally occurring acidic compounds that exist in compost and in richer soils. So keep it up with your compost tea, keep it up with your molasses, keep it up with your organic material building, and you're naturally going to be keeping the pH down in a range that's very acceptable to your plants.
Does the azomite affect pH?
No, very little. Azomite has the greatest array of micronutrient compounds, you know, being iron and zinc and boron and molybdenum and manganese and cobalt and all those things, but has very little effect, if any, on pH. Green sand now, which, and you know, I call azomite like green sand on steroids, green sand, because it has a little more sulfur in it, will be slightly more acidic, but again, if you're looking for any one thing that's going to help lower pH, it's probably going to be one of the humate products from Medina.
Okay. Now, any luck on the planning body to start the NOLO production again?
We haven't heard. We've put our request out, and nobody's come back and said we're going to do that. We were hopeful that the folks at Packaged Beneficial Nematodes would pick it up, but they're over their heads getting their new location established, and I'm not as optimistic at this point, but we're continuing to push forward, and hopefully somebody will pick it up. It's not easy to grow these cultures and be able to stabilize them, and the Semaspore is or NOLO, whichever. The Nosema locustri is what they are trying to create, or to propagate, I guess would be a better word. And it just takes a good lab and takes a lot of knowledge and a lot of time. And some years there'll be a limited market for it. Other years we'll be begging for it. But I keep telling them it's a good thing to build up naturally in the environment. So hopefully we'll get there, but not there yet.
I put that bug in Mr. Frankie's ear, so I'm hoping it's still buzzing in his ear, and maybe he'll start that.
Well, he, like you and me, he is one busy man, and we've got about three or four things we've been bugging him about, but if he can figure a way to do it, he will do it and do it a very good job of it. He has a very limited lab capacity, and it would be a whole new venture for him. But what we need to do is get him to find somebody else to produce it and then let him package it and put his name on it if he wants it. But it's probably not going to happen over in Hondo. I just don't, as busy as he is, I don't see him building a separate laboratory to produce microbes. But he knows everybody in the industry, so hopefully maybe he will find somebody, get them producing it, and he can package it and market it for them.
One last question on that azomite powder. Is that fine enough to go through the filter screens and pop up, or in sprinklers, yard sprinklers?
In lawn sprinklers and things like that, yes, it'll grow through that without any problem. It depends on, you know, just how fine a screen you're running it through. I don't know how it would do on your proportioner, because many of those have very, very fine screens on them. But as far as going through a standard sprinkler line or something like that, it's going to do it. It's a rock powder, so it doesn't dissolve. It goes into suspension rather than solution, kind of like a lot of things you put in your compost tea, and that's why you have to keep it agitated. But don't put too much in, it should go through your sprayer just fine.
Well, I re-rigged my field sprayer with those little pop-up sprayers that just read my compost tea, other than those chemical sprayers, which do a fine mist. thinking about doing a section of the field with the azomite powder just to see how that does.
There'd be nothing wrong with it. Don't mix it too strong, but I think you're just going to have to experiment to see what kind of dilution is going to go through your sprayer easily. But I think you'll be fine with a micronized form of it.
Any ideas on keeping 200 gallons mixed up while running through the field?
Well, you know, many times, and it depends on what you've got going. There are little aerifiers, little bubblers that I don't have one. I've never used one, but I know that they make agitators, which are basically just bubblers to go into a spray tank. But you'd need to talk to a good equipment dealer or, you know, somebody that has a bigger operation even than you do to get the answer to that. Or you might, depending on what kind of sprayer you have, you might look up the company that makes that sprayer, and they may make an attachment of some sort that you can put on there that'll increase the agitation.
All right. You're talking about air bubblers and the stones. Will that be like the same thing that you brew the compost tea with?
There are many different ways of producing bubbles, and as you've noticed in making compost tea, we generally want a pretty fine bubble, but we want a heck of a lot of them. We don't want it to look like a boiling ocean out there. So it would be similar, but you're probably going to use something that makes bigger bubblers. Probably, you know, the same sort of thing that you put in a live bait well on a boat or something like that is what you'd be looking at.
Okay. All right. Well, good deal. I appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure visiting with you, Clint. Get out and enjoy this beautiful weekend.
Take care.
Yeah. All right, sir. You too. Let's get Robert in here before the news break. Good morning, Robert.
Well, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Last week we spoke about the many blue bonnet plants that were popping up in the yard.
Yes, sir.
And then this week I was going through my refrigerator, and in the back of the refrigerator was a jar of the blue bonnet seeds that I had harvested last year. And so they've been sitting in a glass jar in the refrigerator. Should I put them out now, or is it too late, or...?
It's awful late. You know, look into your crystal ball and see how long our cooler weather is going to last. The problem is with bluebonnets, they're what we call biennials. They have to go through two different life stages, so to speak. They make that little rosette of leaves like you're seeing coming up, and that has to grow and mature before they move into the second phase of life, which is putting up that bloom spike. So... we're practically to the 1st of March. No, sir, I think I'd probably leave them right where they are. Bluebonnet seed can last in nature for, you know, probably 30, 40 years. So one more season in your refrigerator is going to probably be okay. But unless you want to move to Colorado and put them out up there where I think they'd be fine. Or if you have friends, you know, in the northern tier, that you'd like to send them to and say, hey, try these, you can do that. But here in Texas, I really think you're probably too late to do them this season.
Oh, okay. Well, at least I know I wasn't sure the other question was that you answered. I can save them for next season.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Keep them in that jar because you don't want them to over dehydrate, and keep them cool. And, you know, again, they can lie in the ground. If the conditions aren't right for them to germinate, they can lie there for many years, 10, 15 years, and still remain viable. So one more season, your refrigerator is not going to stop them too much. But I'm just thinking of two or three things I needed to do today that I totally forgot to get ready to do. So don't beat yourself up for not remembering to put them out. They'll be fine next time around.
So next time around should be more like October or something?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And people always say, well, Mother Nature plants them in June or July. And that's true, but we have those years where we get a good rainy spell in July, maybe a tropical storm or something like that. The bluebonnets sprout, and then the weather shuts off with the rain for, you know, August and September, and all those little sprouted seedlings die. So that's why we put them out a little later. That's why we put them out in October rather than June and July when Mother Nature's planting them. Water if you can, and hopefully you'll not only be adding some more seed, but hopefully those little plants that are still in the rosette stage, hopefully they're going to give you a bunch of flowers and a lot more seed this year.
Well, very good. And of course, those plants that are already out there, they'll make their own seed and
distribute
their own.
And one more thing is having the seed having gotten a little bit older, you'll probably need to scarify it to increase germination. If you want to hold on a minute or two longer, I'll get Greg to put you back on hold, and we'll come back right after news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
Open line, so grab one up. We're going to visit a little bit more with Robert, but you could be next. And you know what the number is, 210-599-5555. And back to visit with Robert a little bit more. The thing that makes bluebonnet seeds able to last so long and, you know, remain viable in the environment is that they have a... they have sort of a layer of wax that surrounds the seeds, and the longer they stay dry, the longer they sit out there waiting for the appropriate conditions to sprout, the harder that little seed coat becomes. So if you know, seed that's a year or two or 3 years old is still very viable, but some of that seed will sprout this year, some of it next year, some of it several years from now. If you want to get the maximum out of older seed, or if you're just not sure how fresh the seed is, it's good to do what we call scarifying it. If you're doing a whole bunch of it, you'd find somebody with a gym tumbler, throw your seed in there with a little carborundum or something, and just tumble it for a few minutes. Most people will maybe just scratch it lightly, put a couple of pieces of sandpaper, put the seed between it, and just rough it up a little bit. Then soak it in some Garrett juice. Garrett juice with its apple cider vinegar will help those seeds hydrate and help them to sprout a good deal. But that's the only thing that you're really going to change having older seed rather than fresh seed. Fresh seed, that seed coat is still real soft, and the seed that you harvest this year or the seed that gets away from you, a lot of it is going to sprout next year with no help at all from you. And visiting with the fellow who owns Wild Seed Farms, he was telling me that when they harvest the seed, and they develop special machines to do this, they harvest, I believe it was about 400 pounds of seed per acre of bluebonnets, and they figured they got about a third of the seed. So, you know, as long as you let the seed develop, as long as you don't mow it down, mow the seed heads, the flower blooms, which form the seed heads down, you'll have a lot of bluebonnets reseed there. And you may want to save this seed that you'll be taking out of the refrigerator, maybe to start a new bed or, you know, plant around somewhere else.
Yes, that was my thought for this year. But now this, I've already, while we were on hold there, I put it on my calendar for October to scatter those seeds and to scarify first. So,
well, you're better than me if you're that efficient about getting it into your calendar. Now, you know, the phones do other things to remind you. My old paper calendar, I just have to remember to look at it. But that's sure what I would do this spring.
Very good. Yeah, that should be easy enough. I can enjoy my bluebonnets this year that will be popping up.
Well, do you have? Is this an area you can irrigate, or is this just out in the field?
No, just my yard.
Okay. Well, give them a little moisture every couple of weeks if Mother Nature doesn't provide it, and just remember when you water, water very thoroughly. But if your little plants have formed that little cluster of leaves and are starting to come up, you've got a lot going for you. Keep an eye out for pill bugs. They are the one thing that likes to eat on the tender leaves of new bluebonnets just sprouting, and you can put out a little bit of the bait that will control them, or you can spray a little spinosad around. But do go out and, you know, get down on your knees and take a close look at those little rosettes of leaves, because they They are somewhat susceptible to a little bit of insect damage at this stage.
Okay. That should be kind of obvious, so if they're eating on those seeds,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And if you want to put out something dry and easy, the Sluggo Plus, which is what we use for snails and slugs, you don't want to get just plain Sluggo. You want to get the Sluggo Plus that has the spinosad in it. You just get a little of that and sprinkle it around. Goes a long way, and that'll take care of snails, slugs, and pill bugs and should protect those seedlings very well.
Okay. I did get a few tomato plants the other day, Celebrity and Juliet.
Good for you.
One other one. So I guess just with the maybe putting those out today too, I guess.
Well, I think, you know, I haven't planted mine, but it's for lack of time rather than anything else. But my recommendations, when I plant my tomatoes, I go ahead and put the tomato cage down over the top of them, and then I'll take that little thin layer of row cover, cut a strip maybe 18 inches wide, just wrap around the tomato cage, clip it on with a couple of clotheslines, just to keep the wind off, because the wind is just so dehydrating. The wind does more damage than cold down to the level of frost, so I'm to the point I wouldn't hesitate planting them, and just be vigilant. And if we are going to get the potential of more frost, then you go out and just cut a little square of the insulate and close pin it over the top. But it's this kind of weather, looking 10 days down the road and seeing afternoons in the 70s and 80s, makes you realize it's time to get the tomato plants going.
Yes. Well, excellent, Bob. I appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure, Robert. I appreciate the call this morning, and let's go on and talk with David next. Good morning, David.
Hey, Bob. How you doing this morning?
Off to a good start. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good.
Have you heard of the new GMO tomato?
No, I haven't. What are they doing now?
A company called Norfolk has developed a tomato. It's called Purple. It's a mix between a cherry tomato and snapdragon, purple snapdragon.
Interesting.
And it's out there. Yes, sir, it is. And what's more interesting is that America's favorite seed company, if I won't say, took this GMO, tried to pass it off as an heirloom, and got caught. And they put it on their front page. It was going to be the big heirloom thing this year.
Uh-huh.
The front page, their catalog, and the other company said stuff about it, and so there's a big deal going on about it now.
And tell me the name once again.
The company who developed it is Norfolk.
Yeah, but no, the name of this tomato.
Oh, it's called the Purple Tomato.
Oh, just called the Purple Tomato?
Yes, sir, by Norfolk. And by the other company, it's called the Purple Galaxy.
Purple Galaxy. I was not aware of that, and that's what I count on you guys to let me know, and I really do appreciate it. Its claim to fame is not insect resistance or disease resistance. It's just a new and different color is what they're promoting.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. It's still not going to be in my garden. You know, they're showing the more research they do, the more they find out that these genetically modified things are just not good for the environment, and, you know, who knows what is in that fruit. And not going to affect everybody, but people who are sensitive to, you know, some of the things that result from messing with the natural genetics of the plant. It's not a good thing, but I very much appreciate you being the watchdog and telling me about it, David. Thank you.
All right. That's all I have today, Bob.
Well, I appreciate the call. You get out and have a wonderful weekend, and let me know when you hear more. I won't be growing any of them, and you probably won't either, but you probably have some friends that don't think quite as hard, aren't quite as smart, and let me know how it looks as we get into the season. But once again, very much appreciate the call.
All right, take care.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Let's pause for a break. Let's pause for a break here while you grab one of those phone lines at 210-599-5555. I get to talk to you about Nature's Creation, and they want me to remind you that that spreadable corn gluten meal that they produce, which is the best natural pre-emergent on the market, you better get it out. You can't wait until those spring weeds sprout. And with this stretch of weather up in the 70s, that soil is warming, and you may very well be overrun with dandelions and, oh gosh, all the different things that come up from seed, the henbit, the clovers, the oxalis, the winter grass or rescue grass. The spreadable corn gluten meal from Nature's Creation is an easy product to put out. It's an all-natural product and doesn't have any real negatives attached to it at all. But and the way it works is it allows the seed to sprout but keeps it from developing a root system. So long as we stay dry, like the weather's forecast to be the next couple of weeks, it'll probably be pretty effective. But remember, once those weeds germinate, pre-emergent no longer works. That's what pre-emergent means. It happens before things sprout. But there's no better one on the market than the spreadable corn gluten meal from Nature's Creation. Nature's Creation makes a lot of other quality products as well, from soil amendments to things like their fungicide cornmeal. Oh, they just package so many good things. Look for them at your favorite nursery or garden center. You'll find it lots of places like Hill Country Africa, Violets up in Burney, King Seed out at Canyon Lake, both locations of Rainbow Gardens, both locations of the Plant House, both New Braunfels and Kerrville. We carry lots of their products here at Shades of Green. Remember that name, Nature's Creation.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. I guess 6:30 is the magic time because all of a sudden the phone lines are full. Hang on just a minute before you dial. It's going to be John and Fred and James and Wade. And looks like John is first in line. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I'm down in Pleasanton.
Very good.
I planted my garden. I planted it at the end of January. I have a couple questions on the peas. Sugar snap peas, whatever have you. Mine will grow to about 5 or 6 feet. I have tons of flowers. I start hand picking them. I do what you do. I really don't, I get more like a bowl, maybe a bowl and a half.
Yeah.
My question is for some reason down in Pleasanton, we have sand and it gets,
right.
It gets hot quick like everybody else, but maybe a little hotter. And I think the sand heats up and then the bottom of my peas just burn out and that's it. And this usually happens in May. Uh-huh. So planning, getting February, March, and April out of them. Is that all I'm going to get out of them?
Well, it depends on how hot it gets. The best thing you can do to keep the soil cooler is just a layer of mulch over it. And it doesn't have to be anything fancy. It could be a layer 2 or 3 inches deep of shredded up leaves. Old Malcolm Beck did an experiment a little later in the summer, but between bare soil and soil out in the sun, and he had, it was like a 50 or 60 degree difference, like the difference in 130 degrees and 80 degrees. So mulches are the thing that is going to keep the soil cooler longer. Now, the other things that limit the life of peas are spider mites. So be sure you're spraying regularly with liquid seaweed, and not if, but when you have the mites show up, spray with a good safe miticide to keep them under control. Keep an eye out too for aphids, because when stressful weather starts, that's when the aphids start showing up. And once again, they will shorten your productive life. Now, some years when we go from relatively nice weather to 105 degrees, the snow peas are just not going to take those kind of temperatures. But mulching the soil, watering very thoroughly when you water, spraying with liquid seaweed to reduce the potential for mites, those are going to extend your pickable season longer than anything else you can do.
Okay, one more question. So keeping the soil cool will help considerably, or attempting to. And then on the potatoes, I did something interesting this year. I start them off as recessed instead of in a mound or flat.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And they came up great. So now they're about 3 inches tall. I'm going to just push, a couple inches of soil back towards them. Is that okay? And then they're just level?
Sure. Sure. Yeah, a lot of people, you know, call it banking, and they may actually put 5 or 6 inches of soil up against them as the plants grow up. I've just never found that it made a whole lot of difference in my production, and that's just one less thing that I have to do in the garden. The benefit of doing what you're talking about doing, the way that you will lose potatoes is they develop with the portion of the potato actually showing, you know, on the soil surface. Where the sunlight hits it, it starts forming chlorophyll, and that basically ruins the potato as far as a good eating potato. At this point, you're putting a little umbrella of soil over them, and that's a good thing. There's nothing at all wrong with doing that. I'm not going to go back and do it again and again to, you know, pile it up 6-8 inches deep around them, but coming back with 2-3 inches probably be a very good idea for you.
Okay, and then have you ever tried taping carrots? Get your glasses out, put about 1.5 feet of tape down, and 1 seed at a time, about 2 inches apart, before you plant them in the soil?
It's, again, the carrot seed is fine, and no, I haven't. I don't normally take that much time. I think the thing that will help is to spread your carrot seed on a piece of something like parchment that you get at the grocery store, what we use to wrap meat and fish and things, and then mist them with the garret juice. That's going to really get them off to a good start. Let them dry, and just anything you can do to spread the seed out a little bit is a good thing, because carrots have to be thinned out. They have to grow up with an 1.5 inches, 2 inches of space between each plant if you're going to get a good carrot. But if it works for you, do it. It's something I've just never taken the time to do. And I'll tell you one thing that's interesting. One of our employees brought in a bunch of carrots from her garden the other day, and the darker pigmented carrots, like the purple ones, they've grown like twice as quickly as the lighter colors have. So, and she doesn't have a big garden, but she plants a carrot mix. And it was just interesting to see. They all pretty much sprouted and grew at the same time, but some colors very definitely got bigger than others. So you might make notes in your own garden, and it'll help you plant more wisely next year.
Okay, thanks for your time, Bob.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for the call this morning. It's a pleasure visiting with you, John. Thank you. It looks like next in line is Fred. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
I want to learn a little bit more about corn gluten meal.
Okay.
Doesn't it have some nitrogen availability when you apply it as well?
Yes. Corn gluten meal is actually has a fairly high nitrogen availability. It will serve, even if it doesn't work totally effectively as a pre-emergent. It will, you know, serve as a good fertilizer. Now, my experience with it is that it doesn't last. I'm not sure, you know, what form the nitrogen is in, but I don't think it's a cation, which means it doesn't really bind to the soil. So it's not going to give you the longer feeding effect that you get from, you know, a manure type of fertilizer or an alfalfa type of fertilizer. But it very definitely has quite a bit of nitrogen in it. It's gonna be a pretty powerful burst of growth it will create.
So, does Nature's Creation have it available for volume use? Because I understand you need to put 15 or 20 pounds to the acre to really get a benefit from it.
I think you probably have to put more than that.
It's 15. It's 15 to 20 pounds per 1,000 square feet, which would be 800 pounds.
Exactly. No, 15 to 20 pounds per acre wouldn't do it. You would have to put it down, and especially down where you are. You're late, in my opinion, because it does absolutely nothing once the seed has sprouted. And my yard, even in the hill country, I've got a lot of Weeds, I guess you would call them. I had a friend that said, you just have to accept that as part of Mother's Nature's diversity. And there's a lot of diversity in my yard already sprouted. So I don't know that I would make the investment in trying to do it acreage wise around the yard, around the garden. Yeah. If it controls even half the weeds, you're that far ahead. But, as you well know, Fred, I'd be looking more at, some other things like the Medina product, like your compost product that you've been working so hard on. I think that's going to give you more suppressant effect at this point than the corn gluten meal will.
So if you apply the Medina growing green at a hefty rate, 700-800 pounds to the acre, you should be able to get some suppression of those undesirable grasses with that, as well as feeding the target plants that you're trying to feed.
Well, yes and no. The suppression that you would get of your weedy plants is just when your beneficial plants come up and shade the weeds out. Unfortunately, the weedy stuff, a lot of it has evolved to sprout earlier and get a pretty good foothold before the native plants and the existing grasses and things really get up. So you're going to get a lot more weed suppression from a compost product because humic acids have a natural pre-emergent effect. Fertilizing is a good thing, but is it going to give you much weed control? And I consider Medina, certainly tops in the field, but I'm not going to tell you it's going to give you a lot of weed suppression except through promoting the growth of your beneficial plants that are already there.
Okay. I have one other thing I want you to think about and see if you can help me understand what's happening.
Okay.
I was looking at some wheat yesterday, and it's for grazing. But when you look out across the field, there's these rings that of green wheat that are a foot tall and just thick and beautiful, dark green. And then the rest of the field is yellow, and it's obviously needing nitrogen. But if you look around all of the harvester ant mounds, there's a ring of wheat that is just beautiful, and it's about 2 feet wide and about a foot tall, and it surrounds every one of those harvester ant dens. What is going on with what the harvester ant is doing that is creating so much available nitrogen around the mound?
Well, keep in mind that it's not just nitrogen, it's iron, it's zinc. There are many different things that promote that, that greenness. That's a great question, and I will have to ask some folks, including I'll make a note here in a moment to ask Kara Garrett about that this morning. But if you were somewhere else, I would tell you it's probably that you're simply getting more oxygen in a hard soil, but you're down in loose open soil, so I don't know. The harvester ant makes a pretty good little underground network of tunnels, and maybe it makes it easier for water to get to the root system. Maybe it's just the fact that there is more oxygen in the soil. That's a good question to ask. I don't have an answer, but I know a lot of people that are smarter than I am, and I'll see if they have an answer for it. But I haven't really noticed that much. I don't have a lot of harvester ants. Now, we saw something absolutely fascinating yesterday or day before, and that is where, and this is an area, like I say, where we have very few harvester ants, but right there at there are two openings to this mound right at the top of the hill. There was the biggest swarm of ants developing wings. It looked like kind of like a moth that has to come out and dry its wings off, and they expand a little bit. But it is getting ready to be a huge flight of both the male and the female ants. And I don't know what would have triggered that, but in this little circle that might have been 8 inches in diameter, there are probably 200 or 300 ants in there developing wings ready to fly off and get together and see about forming new colonies. So that was one of our interesting observations that I really can't explain. Maybe I've just missed it before, but I've never seen that happening, out in the field the way this was. So other interesting things going on with the harvester ants.
Well, they're doing something positive. I mean, they're doing their business, but they're contributing to the nutrient cycle on some level. And
yeah.
I would like to understand. I mean, you know, whatever they're eating, whatever they've brought to the mound to eat, and then whatever's passing through those microbes is just really causing something beautiful to happen. And I'm one of those that's like, why can't we mimic nature? Why can't we figure out what's happening there and make it happen more often?
And that's how we're always going to be most successful. There are people that spend their lives studying ants. So I'll try to track one of them down and see if we can get an answer to that.
It'd be good to know, because we need to figure out how to get more of it.
Amen. Amen to that one, Fred. You and your family have a wonderful weekend. You keep up the good work, and I'll look forward to our next visit.
Have a great day.
You too. Thank you, sir. All right, let's get a break in here. James and Wade will be the next two callers, and looks like I get to talk to you about Rhonda's Nature's Way, and oh, I do enjoy talking about Rhonda's Nature's Way. Good health is everything, and good health, well, you achieve it a lot of different ways. You achieve it through proper supplementation. For most of us, as we get a little older, we really need that. You get it from creating a very strong immune system. I take supplements daily that I get from Rhonda simply for immune building. Other things, golly, some of her products, the clinical OPC, so good for the heart with that grape seed extract. Rhonda's Nature's Way has products that you need that will improve your life and help solve those little issues you might have with digestion or sleep or even mood. Don't be running to the doctor for some pharmaceutical prescription that you'll just fill over and over and have to worry about side effects. Go to Rhonda for natural solutions to all these things. And if you're trying to lose a little bit of weight, she's got a lot of ways to help you there. If you want a really interesting, very, very beneficial experience, make an appointment for a reflexology session. I tell you, leaves you feeling like you're walking around about 6 inches above the ground. She also does beamer light therapy, red light therapy. It's just a wonderful place. Open every day except Sundays and major holidays over in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of across the parking lot there from Sprouts. If you want to feel better naturally, you'll go see my friends at Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, back to the phone lines. It's going to be James and Wade and John and Charlie. James is first in line. Good morning, James.
Morning, Bob. How you doing?
Well, good morning, Farmer James. I'm well. How about yourself?
Oh, just great. I was thinking about what you said. You know, you were looking for somebody smarter than you to talk to. That's got to be a pretty short list, doesn't it?
No, it's a long, long list. I'm one of those people that knows a little bit about a lot of different things, but there are only a handful of things that I feel like I know a lot about. But no, I've been blessed with some wonderful mentors in my life, and I guess we all have. We just need to, so many of them have gone now, but always remember them fondly.
Yep, standing on the shoulders of giants. I'm the same way. Last time I talked, you were talking about hydrogen peroxide for cleaning out the compost tea barrels.
Right.
Well, I was looking. All I got is this 34% that I use in the backpack sprayer to get all the crud out. But how do you use that peroxide? Do you just like go to the store and buy a couple of cans and pour it in there and slosh it around? Or
and you know, you can even dilute it down a little bit. You could use your 37%, but I'd be putting maybe a cup of that to a gallon of water. You have to handle it carefully, as you know, when you get up to 37%. Give me just a minute and I'll tell you the name of the company that does it. They make a lot of good natural soaps and things, but it's called Seventh Generation, and they package what they call, or what is, you know, the bottle says non-chlorine bleach or something like that, and all that is hydrogen peroxide, and I think that's down to, you know, probably about 4 or 5%. It's cheap, and you can use that straight out of the bottle, or you can dilute it maybe 50-50. I'm going to use a little bit stronger because you just don't want to let those biofilms get started because, you know, by the time you see it, it's already probably 1,000 layers deep with potentially some of the not-so-good microbes. But I'm just going to use the seventh-generation non-chlorine bleach. But if you've got 37%, yeah, dilute it down to about a cup per gallon and just use that. Scrub a little if you can. I would always wear gloves when you're handling that 37%. Once you've diluted it, it's not that critical. But just, you know, a stiff brush of any sort, in fact, a toilet bowl brush should probably do the job, just to rub over, just to be sure that you're physically disrupting the biofilm so where the hydrogen peroxide can get in and kill it out. Granted, it kills good microbes as well as bad, but it goes away very, very quickly. H2O2 very quickly becomes H2O plus O2. So it's not anything that's going to leave a lasting residue like Clorox or something like that would. It's one of the reasons I think hydrogen peroxide is so much better as a disinfectant, as a, you know, something to clean up viruses, bacteria, fungi, just about all the negative guys out there.
That's good advice. I'll try that. I got two barrels that need a little bit of cleaning. And
oh, yeah.
I was waiting until I talk to you and find out how to dilute that that strong hydrogen.
Yeah, I dilute it down to about 5%, and I'd have to sit down with my pencil and, you know, and do a little math to tell you. But it's going to be 1 to 2 cups per gallon of water is going to give you probably a cup and a half is going to give you about a 5% solution. And that will be strong enough to do all the cleaning you need to do, but not to the point that you have to worry about handling it.
Oh, okay. And one thing, your previous caller was wanting to space carrots. And
oh, yeah,
I have that real good luck with the pellet seed,
yeah,
that I get from Johnny's.
I agree with you on that. He had a different variety. And that's the only problem with Johnny's is they're a little limited in the number of varieties that they offer as pelletized seed. And some of these heirloom varieties, some of the less common ones, it's you're looking at trying to find a little different way to do it. But no, I'm all for pelletized seed. I'm old enough to remember when the companies used to put out seed tapes where it was actually a water soluble paper tape that had the seed properly spaced through it, and you just put the tape down the row and cover it up with soil. And before the days of pelletized seed, that's how they did it, and it worked just fine.
Yeah, they've got some yellow ones and purple ones and red ones, and I don't grow those. I just grow the sweet ones.
Well, and I'm with you there. I love a sweet carrot, and they're so good for you. They're just one of those things that comes out of the garden that I don't think you'll ever buy the same quality in the grocery store.
Okay, Bob, thanks for all the good advice. I got to clean out those compost tea barrels so I can get going on another batch.
It's that time, James. You get out there and do it, and I will move along and talk to
Bob.
Sir.
Bob, one more thing.
Yeah.
The pheromone trap, the corn earworm,
yeah,
tomato fruit worm, and the bollworm trap. I'm already getting the little male moths in there.
Yeah, those pheromone traps work really well. Have you ever had any, found that you caught any? It's a much bigger moth. But is it all attractive to the squash vine borer moth? Have you ever caught those on your little sticky trap?
Not on the corn earworm.
Yeah.
These are the pheromones. But I'm just amazed that they're out this early in the season.
Well, when you look at that temperature poking 80 degrees when we're not even to the end of February, we're going to see a lot of things out a little bit earlier. And it's why we're recommending for people that have fruit trees and things like that, get those trichogramma out. Those little guys that you're trapping, you got to get rid of them once they're sprouted and or once they are hatched and out. But it's time to get the trichogramma out because I'm afraid this may be the year we see a lot of little caterpillars going after the new growth on our oaks and other things as well. So lots to do in the garden, that's for sure.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, James. Looking at that clock, I better get a break in here so we don't get behind. Wager next, and it's going to be John and Charlie. Looks like I get to talk to you about Kinetico. Love talking about quality products, and I love my Kinetico water softener. I don't know if you're old enough to remember the years that Brad Messer was on KTSA Radio, one of my favorite talk show hosts that always, you know, told the straight truth. It wasn't just, he didn't advertise a product unless he had tried it out and found that it really worked. And Brad's the guy that told me about Kinetico. I got a Kinetico, and now I just like to be, as they say, I can never fill his shoes, but I can follow in his footsteps and tell you what a great product Kinetico Water Softener is. I like them because they don't run on electricity. You don't worry about power surges. You don't worry about lightning strikes. You don't worry about power outages. Your Kinetico system runs on the kinetic energy in the water, which means it's not impacted by power. And it doesn't have that little electronic computer that many of them do that tell it when to reprogram, when to recharge. Kinetico does it automatically. It only recharges when the water or when the rosin in the tank needs to be recharged. You have a twin tank system, so you're never going to run out of soft water, but you're going to save salt and money and water when you have a Kinetico system. They're so sure you'll love it, they'll even give you 90 days to try it before you pay for it. I could go on and on. They can do a whole house system without ever going inside your house. It's a great company doing a great job. If you want to learn more, go to KineticoSA.com. Probably the easiest way. It's just a good company. I hope you enjoy your Kinetico water softener, as I have for many, many years. Kinetico.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get straight back to the phone lines. Wade is next in line. Good morning, Wade.
Good morning, Bob. This is
morning,
Wayne.
Sir.
I'm sorry, I messed your screener up with my slurring my words. But,
well, we got you on, and that's the most important thing, Wayne. Thanks for calling. How can I help?
I tell you what, I got a weird one. I've been working on getting a place that's had mostly brush and stuff. I've been working on kind of clearing it off and getting it the way I want it. I bought the place about 5 years ago. And I just cleared off a bunch of brush area that had wee sats and mesquite trees in it. Mm-hmm. And when I sat cleared it off, I did it with my own tractor. I didn't have bulldozers come through and do it. So
sure.
Anyway, I did it so that I could plant a deer food plot so I could kind of hunt over it.
Uh-huh.
And I put some seed down. And it had, among other things, in some turnips. And this is property that hasn't seen any, from what I can tell, any kind of fertilizer, synthetic fertilizers, or any other kind of fertilizer for that matter. Anyway, I put this some kind of a deer food plot blend down, and I mean, it had turnips in it. And I have got the biggest turnips. I mean, I've got basketball-sized turnips coming out of this thing.
That's
and
amazing.
I'm sitting here, you're talking to your caller that talked about the harvester ants. I want to know what did that, because I want some more of that. It's very interesting, and there's hundreds of them. I don't even like turnips or turnip greens, and now I'm kind of enjoying these. Are very sweet purple-top turnips. And I've had a lot of fun with it. So do you have any idea what's going on with that?
Well, it's hard to say. One thing that I would tell you, the thing that limits most people's success with turnips is they don't thin them properly. They get the seed too close together, and you know, it's just they crowd each other out and they get all tops but no, you know, no root, so to speak. Considering that your turnips came in a blend, chances are that you just naturally, when you went out and planted, did you drill it in? Did you just broadcast your seed? How did you plant this field?
I broadcast them, and they're probably on the spacing of, I mean, they, you know, you hit a couple of them, there are three or four of them right next to each other.
Uh-huh.
But for the most part, if I had to average it out, I'd say they're, I don't know, six, 8 inches apart.
I'd say it's probably just the diluting effect of your other seed. and the weather was just right for turnips, apparently. You got the right rain that was soft and gentle, didn't wash the seed, you know, away, but enough to, you got rains at the right time. I kind of doubt that it had anything necessarily to do with the soil, other than the fact that, like you said, this soil hasn't been over-fertilized with synthetic things that burn the organic material out. And Mother Nature brings, you know, some natural fertilizer in with lightning storms and things like that. And turnips are one of those things that don't require a huge amount of nitrogen to do well. You apparently just have the right texture of soil, and the weather cooperated, and you spaced your seed out well because it was part of a blend. Beyond that, your guess is as good as mine, is why they did so well. It'll be interesting to see if they do that well again next year.
Well, I wish there was a way I could broadcast my number down here for people that like turnips, because it's hard to see them go to waste. I'm gonna have to in a few weeks probably go out there and disc them under, and because that's part of the reason I planted them was
sure.
it was some pretty dense soil under all those trees, mm-hmm. and I was told that putting those turnips in there would be a way of maybe loosening the soil up. And
Where approximately are you, Wade? Wayne.
Down around Kennedy in Shoke, Texas, about 50 miles south of you.
You know, go to your local feed store and just ask them if you can put a little note up on the board that says, turnips for sale cheap, or come haul them, I got turnips, or something like that. And I bet you'll find a bunch of people, because they're pretty good forage for pretty good nutrition for a lot of different animals. And if you put that word free up, I know you get a bunch of takers.
Well, if I disc them back into the system, will it, I mean, I guess obviously it puts organic matter back in it, but I guess it won't take any of the nutrients out either, huh?
No, you're not going to harm it in any way, but if you wanted to self-seed, you've got to let the tops get up to where it can bloom and make more seed, and it just depends on how hungry the deer are. Depends on whether you turn on any cattle or sheep or goats or whatever to graze it. But if you want them to come back from seed, just remember the turnips have to bloom and make more seed to self-seed. Did you know when you bought the seed, when you bought this blend, that it was going to be full of turnips?
I knew it was going to have turnip seed in it. That's part of the reason I kind of focused in on it. I didn't know it was going to do this.
Well, you've done well, and you don't have to know exactly what's going on to appreciate it. But since you didn't do anything special to the land, it's my thought that it probably had a lot to do with weather and had to do with the density or lack of the seed that you put out. So take some pictures. It may be a while before we see that again.
Right. I have, and I figured you'd get a kick out of it anyway, because it was, you know, it's interesting to me, the place that I planted them in was, it actually used to have an old town about 100 years ago. I actually got the plat of it on my, mm-hmm. on my land survey, but it's just interesting. It's been kind of a interesting little thing where people at my church laugh at me about it. So there you go.
Well, nothing. They're laughing with you rather than laughing at you, and that's one of the nicer things.
Right.
One of the nicer things in life.
You bet. Well, thank you a lot, Bob. I appreciate you, man.
You're welcome, Wayne. I appreciate the call. And looks like I'm only about a minute away from news. So, John and Charlie, you'll be up right after this news break. Couple of open lines. Grab one if you like. 210-599-5555. Lots of folks going to be out planting tomato plants this weekend. Be sure that you put that layer of rock phosphate in the bottom of the hole. I just dig a hole, grab a handful of rock phosphate, and throw it in. You do not blend it into the soil, because when it's mixed with soil, rock phosphate becomes tied up to where the plants can't get to it. When you put a layer of it in the bottom of the hole, plant your tomato plant on top of it. it and let the roots grow down through there. We owe a big word of thanks to old Malcolm Beck when he was alive. He actually one year weighed the tomato production he got on the plants that he used it. The ones that he didn't, he found that he got twice as many pounds of tomatoes where he used that thin layer of rock phosphate in the bottom of the hole. So not something you apply after you plant. You do it when you plant. Then if you want to put a little Epsom salts on top to head off the possibility of any blossom end rot or anything like that. We'll talk more after the news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be John and Charlie and Paul. John is first in line. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning.
Bob, I've been talking to you about the girdling roots and stuff on some trees that I have.
Right.
And the what I've noticed, that, you know, before it looked like half the tree was dying and couldn't figure out why. Maybe it was up against the wall. Maybe it wasn't because it wasn't. But as I'm pulling, as I've gotten that air spaded out and looking, it appears that when those roots grow almost into the tree,
right,
the part above that is what's dead.
And that's exactly right. It's not 100% because there is some blending, but the roots coming out from the right side of the tree are going to provide the most support to the branches on the right side of the tree or the left side or wherever. And that's a very good observation and a very accurate observation. And when you get a problem with that girdling root, and it doesn't have to go all the way around the trunk, it doesn't have to form a noose to do the damage, just growing tightly against that side messes up the flow of material up and down the trunk, and it will stunt it at first, and then it can actually kill the growth on that side of the tree. So that should definitely improve once you have gotten rid of that of the culprit, so to speak. And you have to be careful because sometimes there's so much tension built up there that you cut it and it can pop just like, you know, cutting a stretched rubber band. So if you're doing it yourself, do it very, very carefully. And sometimes you may have to get down there with a chisel, but it is important to get rid of that root.
Yeah, that's why we've had I've had two guys working for 3 or 4 days on my trees trying to cut those off. But one of what I was calling mainly about was that, you know, some of them look like they have grown into the tree. I mean, the trunk comes down, and then there's like, I hate to say it, but like a club foot, you know.
You
know, because one side of the tree trunk is normal all the way down, and then you come out and there's this huge. And I'm just wondering how much damage can you do trying to get rid of that, or how much, you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, if it is actually buried down in the tissue, don't worry about it. I guess all of us have probably seen, well, all of us that live in the country have seen where somebody had like a barbed wire fence or something or other nailed to a tree, and you see how the tree has almost totally overgrown the wire. It's now buried down inside the tree trunk. At that point, it is reestablishing some of those little xylem and phloem vessels, you know, on the other side of that. So if it's a small root that looks like it's grown in, where the truth is the tree is just, you know, overgrown the root, all you really need to do is cut it at each end. You don't have to try to pry it out. If you can still see the root, it would be good to get rid of it if you can, but that's not mandatory. The important thing is cut it at each end, stop it from growing any more. And ones that have been there around for there a long time, the tree trunk has probably overgrown them already, and it's just not necessary, not worth the damage you do trying to get that trouble-causing root all the way out.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about, is where to cut them, because a lot of them go, most of them that I'm having the real problem with go about halfway around the tree, and then they, you know, continue on out. The hard part is they come out of the tree close, girdle around it, and then go out. So I would really be able to only cut one end of it. Would that, I guess that'd be since
Well, if you can cut the end, we would call that the end. Well, let's just call it the end that's closest. If you cut the end where it came out of the trunk, then one cut would do it. If you've cut the other end where it was hopefully heading out away from the tree, that's going to stop it, and that root may just spread out and continue to cause other problems. So cut both ends if you can, just to be sure you've gotten it. If it's such that you can take hold of it and literally pull it out of the groove that has formed in the tree, all the better. But, you know, don't do a whole lot of damage to the trunk just trying to get rid of that root. Just cut it both ends as best you can.
And what would be the next? I mean, I was thinking about trying to take some, like, Garrett juice and maybe some Super Thrive and stuff like that because, you know,
yeah,
a lot of them are coming. There's 2 and 3 girding roots to the tree.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
They're pretty much suffering. And really, I thought last year it was because of the drought, and I'm sure some of it was. But yeah, I'm looking now that they're just, I mean, they're like it's more than one.
Well,
I mean, some of them do have one on each side.
Yeah, look at DirtDoctor.com, and the more of the sick tree treatment that you can do, the better. Just using some Garrett juice, using some Super Thrive, using a good fertilizer, either liquid or dry, all those things are going to help. But, you know, other things like the cornmeal, the lava sand, the little green sand, compost, all those things are going to help the trees even more. But you've got a big job. You've apparently got a lot of trees that you've had to do it on. And I begin with the Garrett juice and maybe a little Super Thrive added, then go back and do the rest of the sick tree treatment as you are able to do it. You're getting rid of the roots. You're getting rid of the negative effect of the girdling roots. So you've made a great first step.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. I won't take up any more time. I appreciate it.
Always appreciate your call. Thank you, John. Charlie's next in line. Good morning, Charlie.
Hey, good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
Going back to your caller, you're talking about the ants.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be worth it to do like a soil core where everything is green and the soil core where everything's yellow and then do a soil, you know, and look at the soil and see what the
if you wanted to, you know, spend $25 on a test, it would be interesting. I don't really know. And of course, if you're going to send a soil sample off, you would send it to, Texas Plant Soils Labs down in the valley. They do the only reliable soil test, in my opinion. But there are just so many different possibilities. I mean, it may be that those ants have somehow brought in or stimulated the growth of a mycorrhizal fungus that's gotten associated with the roots of the plants that's creating this big burst of growth. It could be something that the ants are excreting or secreting, one or the other. It's just it'd take a lot of observation, and if you had the resources to do some actual scientific testing, that would be great. But I don't know that you're going to learn something that you can replicate and take advantage of. So at this point, it's just how hard do you want to work to satisfy our curiosity? And, you know, it'd be very interesting to take a sample and see if they have indeed increased the nitrogen content. But it may very well be down on a microbial level. And while mycorrhizal fungi form a pretty big network of hyphae, we know that roots, we know that stems, we know that leaves many times are coated several layers deep with beneficial both bacteria and fungi. So, and there's, you know, you'd have to find a different lab. You'd have to find somebody like Elaine Ingham or someone who has a little bit more specialized equipment to cover all the bases of what might be causing, you know, the greener foliage. And, of course, the gentleman we were talking to is operates in South Texas, has a wonderful feed and farm and ranch supply store down there. And so if there's some way we could capitalize on that knowledge, it would be worth making the investment to do it. Otherwise, we're just trying to satisfy our curiosity. And I don't know if any you come up with any ideas, or if you decide to send Noe a couple of samples down to TPSL, the Plant Soils Lab, it would be interesting to see. But they're just, you know, to do a true scientific test, you have to narrow it down to just one variable, and there's no way you're going to do that in a field.
Right. Well, I thought, yeah, it might not tell you what it is, but it might eliminate what it's not.
But, that's an excellent way to put it. I can't think of a better way to express it, but it would heighten my curiosity if it came back, no, the levels of all the major and minor nutrients are the same, then we've got to look further, and then it would be, I think, most likely microbial life of some sort. But I'm interested to talk to Howard Garrett after 8 o'clock and see if he has observed any of that phenomenon, and certainly any other callers that may have noticed it. I have limited numbers of harvest ants around my ranch, and I can't say that I've ever really seen that, but most of the time, you know, their mounds come up in the middle of a fairly green area anyway, so it's never caught my eye. So it's just, it's an interesting mystery at this point.
Yes, sir. Real quick question. The Velcro plant, you know, yeah. I've sprayed, there's some of it I've sprayed twice with the 9% vinegar and orange oil.
Right.
And it's like nothing was ever happened to it. Others, it's taken care of it. It's eliminated
yeah.
it. There,
you have a whole lot of it or just a limited amount of it?
It's, I would say limited.
Okay.
I'm trying to keep it in check.
Yeah. I go ahead and spend the money to get a jar of the 20% vinegar. That I think you'll find will knock it out 100%. And if you're trying to do an acre, no, that would probably get into more spent money than it'd be worth. But
in the back part of the backyard. So
yeah, it's
small.
Yeah, it's and for people who don't know it by that name, bed straw is another common name for it. It is one of the fastest growing little noxious weeds. I mean, it's not as persistent as, you know, nutsedge and some of the other things that come up, because it will go away with hot weather, but it does not only stick to you everywhere you get near to it, but it makes a little seed burr that does the same thing. And I tend to go after it with a hay fork.
Right.
And just, you know, you pile it up 4 feet wide and 3 feet deep, and a week later you're down to just this little dried up mass on the ground. But it's a big nuisance, and the rains really came at just the right time for it this year, because it is sure up and growing.
Yeah, and it's amazing. It's the smallest root, and if you pull it, you know, it'll pull right mm-hmm. out.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's amazing what it can do with such a small root.
Yeah.
And not that deep. It's just amazing.
Oh, pull as much of it as you can before it starts blooming and going to seed, because right now you're just going to have to pick some little pieces of the plants off your shirt or your jacket or pants. But if you wait till it goes to bloom, it's a lot more obnoxious, shall we say. And if you've got a long-haired dog, keep them away from it, or you'll be spending a lot of time brushing.
Right. Yeah, that's why I've been spraying it before it blooms. So,
yeah.
Okay. Well, that's all I had. So,
Charlie,
I appreciate
great thoughts, and always good to talk to you. Thank you so much, sir.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye. All right, let's get a break in here. Paul will be up next. We do have a couple of open lines, so grab one of them if you like. I'm going to talk to you about Sam Sitterly and Green Grow Organics. You know, I've recommended Sam for years as a consultant, because he's 30-some-odd years in business, always doing things organically, man with a good mind and strong observation skills and lots of education. He's the guy that can identify problems, come up with good natural solutions to them, and he still continues that business big time. Has, oh, even some of our customers even call him Saint Sam, because they say he's done so much to save their landscapes. And if you need a good consultant, he is still out there. But I love his new program, where he and his staff will arrange to come out on a quarterly basis and do the fertilizing, do the beneficial nematode application. At least once a year, they provide micronutrients as well. It's kind of the same idea as the chemical guys, in that they come out quarterly, but the difference is big. You don't have to sign a long-term contract, very reasonably priced, and they're never going to use a toxic product. Everything Sam and his crews do, all natural, all organic. So, good guy with a great new program. His company is called Green Grow Organics. He is Sam Sitterly. Check him out on the web. If you want to give him a call, 210-599-5565, and talk to him about his new quarterly program with the compost tea, the beneficial nematode application. Sam's out there doing it right, unlike the chemical guys that are still spraying poisons. Sam Sitterly, Green Grow Organics.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone line. It's going to be Paul, Turkey Tom, Victor, and Elizabeth. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Which abelia would I have the best success with in a bright, shaded area? Or would you say don't even try?
It depends on how it needs to be. It needs to have several hours of direct sun to do well. Abelia is just a sun-loving plant. The green varieties, whether and probably just your compact abelia, is going to be about the hardiest in that situation, as opposed to the variegated ones. They're a bunch of gorgeous variegated ones, but anytime you've got variegation, you've got less chlorophyll, less green, and, you know, less ability to absorb the sun's energy when you're in a little shadier spot. So, I'd tell you, if you don't have at least 4 or 5 hours of strong sun, midday sun, abelia is probably not the best plant for you. It's a wonderful plant, but it does love the sun.
Okay. Well, I get about maybe 2.5 hours, I think, of direct sun, and the rest is very bright shade.
Is it 2.5 hours from, noon till 2 o'clock, or is it 2.5 hours from 9 until 11 or something?
Like 1 and after.
Yeah.
Or maybe 1 to 3, something like that.
Buy yourself a 1 gallon one and see how it does. Spend $10 to figure out if it's going to do well before you go out and spend a bunch of money on bigger ones. But I would definitely go with the solid green one. And it may be brighter than you think, but I sure wouldn't plant a hedge of them until you figure that out.
Okay, so Kaleidoscope would not be a variety. Which one would be?
Just probably the compact. Just your compact abelia. So far as I know, that it's probably abelia, Nana or something like that. But if you just ask for the compact Nandina, it's one that's going to grow about 4 feet tall for you, very full, very thick. Just compact is what you're looking for.
Great. Okay, that's it for me, Bob. Thank you.
Great question. I appreciate the call, and good luck with it. Turkey Tom next. Good morning, Turkey Tom.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
I think I made a mistake. I've got some grapevines, and I did all my pruning back beginning of January, which was perfect. And then last week I said, there's one more section I need to prune off on two vines. And now I've got a whole bunch of dripping cuts on these vines. Is there anything I can do to stop the dripping?
Not really, and there's no need to try to do that. I mean, obviously, as they say, the sap is rising. It's just stuff coming up through the xylem tissue in the middle of the stem. And I'm glad it's not dripping on your car or something like that. But it will stop on its own, and you haven't created a big problem. It's still going all the places you want it to go. It just happens to be going one place you didn't want it to go. So it's a nuisance, but not a problem.
Yeah, I've learned my lesson for next year. Definitely do all my pruning in January and don't second guess myself.
Right. And do write it down to remind yourself because, in today's world, next January will be here before you know it and you'll be saying, now, what was it I was supposed to do or not do? So keep that little garden journal out there just to remind yourself of what you've done right as well as what you haven't done right.
Yes, sir. I keep a full log so I can look back on the year past and remember what I did good and try to forget what I didn't.
And the, right. that thing of things I shouldn't have done takes up a lot of space in my book.
Mine as well.
But we always learn from it. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I had a crazy idea. So we've got a bunch of Mustang grapevines on our mm-hmm. on our property here, and there's a bunch of vines that are male. You know, they don't produce grapes. Is it possible to graft a either female Mustang grapevine onto the male, or maybe take an improved variety of grape and graft that onto the male vine?
Grapes are grafted all the time. In fact, you know, a lot of people do this. They'll graft different varieties onto a rootstock that's resistant to Pierce's disease. Most varieties of grapes are not really separate male and female plants. So, you know, maybe lack of pollination. You have to look at the flowers and, you know, determine that. But, there certainly are other varieties of grape that, that aren't quite as sour, shall we say. Mustang grape, great hardy vine. It's just not a table grape. It makes great juice. It makes great wine. But, if you wanted to graft a different variety onto a Mustang rootstock, you'd be just fine to do so.
Okay. I may try that. We always pick our Mustang grapes and make a bunch of jelly every year, but mm-hmm. I've noticed out of the 8 or 9 vines on the property, only 2 are female and the rest never produce fruit, which apparently they're a male vine. So I was wondering about, you know, doing something to those male vines and leave some of it intact, but
sure,
you know, put something else on there that'll actually get me some more grapes.
Well, again, it's one type of grafting that I've never done. I did fruit tree grafting and things back in my college days, but you'll have to find somebody with a little bit more expertise. But I know that it's very commonly done to achieve a better rootstock, so no reason not to give it a try. But, Gim, you're probably going to need to talk to one of the ag agents or somebody like that who can point you to someone who actually has done a bunch of the grafting to help you do it properly. Like, say, it's just something that I've not done, so I'm not qualified to really tell you about that.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Bob. You have a good morning.
Well, you do the same. Making a note here about that. But you get out and enjoy the day as well, Tom. And, Victor, hang on. I better get a break in here. Talking about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center, and such a pleasure that is. 85 years anniversary this year. That's a long time. And Fanix has been right there in the same spot over on Home Green Road all those years. Still specializing, you know, because they have so much room. I'd have to say their two specialties are roses and fruit trees. They've had fruit trees for a little while, but right now they've got their first big shipment of blooming roses in, and they're beautiful, and you really need to get over and see them. Still, for a few more days, 30% off on houseplants. If you're looking for trees, they've got fruit trees. They've got multi-grafted fruit trees. They've got shade trees. They've got mountain laurels. Lots of trees in stock over at Fanix, and the list goes on and on. Lots of spring veggies, seed potatoes, still have some onions, I believe, and lots of the things that need to go in the vegetable garden right now. Plenty of organic fertilizers, good compost. It's just always a great day to visit Fanix. They're only closed on major holidays or occasionally for a day they've got to do maintenance, but this time of year, pretty much count on their being there every day. I know they get too busy to take very many phone calls, but you can always check out the website at fanicnursery.com. They're doing some extra programs, doing some extra sales this year to celebrate 85 years. Always fun to go see our friends at Fanix Nursery and Garden Center.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. It's going to be Victor and Elizabeth and Donna and Ron. Victor is first in line. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Bob. I just have one question. I was given a small bag of ironite, and mm-hmm. I wanted to know what was the proper mixture per gallon of water so I can put it on my potted plants. It is ironite 101. I guess that's the racial or whatever you call it.
Well, it's not a product I recommend to you. I would be reluctant to put it on potted plants. Ironite is basically made from mine tailings, and sometimes you get some pretty nasty things in with it. And I'd be very reluctant to use it on pots. Maybe in your yard, you're probably not going to have any problems. But if you're looking for micronutrients, get some azomite. Get it just in the dry form and put it on and water it. If you want to get a liquid iron product, you can do so. But I'm not going to recommend ironite to you. It's just got too many potential toxins in it. So if they don't have any directions on the container, they probably don't really intend it to be used on pot plants. But probably has a high salt content too. I really would worry about you killing your pot plants with it.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Bob. Thanks. I'll look for that other stuff you said.
Yeah, don't buy any more ironite. Just things like Garrett juice are going to help to free up the natural minerals and things that are in the soil. In fact, if you want something that'll be 20 times better than that, put some azomite on the soil, follow it up with some Garrett juice, and you'll be giving your plants just the best care you can imagine without any toxicity or any danger to yourself or your pets.
Oh, that sounds good, but it was azomite and Garrett juice.
Yes, sir.
All right, Bob, thank you very much, and you enjoy your rest of your day.
I enjoy every day, Victor, and I appreciate your call this morning. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All right, next in line is Elizabeth. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I got in.
Yeah, well, I'm mimicking Tom Tynan. I remember him. Wish we had him back on KTSA sometimes. But people would call and say, thanks for taking my call. And Tom would always say, thanks for calling. And that's the same way I feel. How can I help you today?
That's really nice. I heard you talking earlier about expecting an early influx of our spring caterpillars.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of oak trees that were just completely stripped 2 years ago. Wasn't
right.
A problem last year.
Yeah.
And all I know to do is spray them with BT as soon as I see any little caterpillars.
You can do that, and they are very definitely cyclical, and 1 year we'll have a horde of them that'll strip the trees, and next year we won't have one. There is a very interesting little parasitic wasp, tiny little thing, non-stinging, and this little wasp is called a trichogramma. People call them tea wasps because you don't want to have to spell trichogramma, but you get a little paper card that's maybe 3/4 inch wide and about 4 inches long, and it has thousands of trichogramma larvae on it. What is on there, it looks almost like sandpaper, but what it is moth eggs that have this little developing wasp inside of them. You hang them out in the tree, you take a thumbtack, put them to the side. Fire ants would like to go in and eat them, so if you've got fire ants around, I think it's best to take a little piece of monofilament fishing line or something and just hang them up. But this little card will have several thousand developing wasp larvae. These little tiny, almost gnat-sized wasps go out and find the eggs of the caterpillars and parasitize them before they can hatch. They're not like your bigger paper wasps that actually kill the caterpillars, but this keeps the little egg that would become a caterpillar from ever hatching in the first place. And again, you put out maybe 4 or 5 of these little cards per acre. If you've got a big tree, you probably hang 2 of these little cards on opposite sides of the tree. It will do as much good as spraying, and it's a whole lot less work.
Well, and not only that, I can't reach the tops of my trees.
Exactly.
I've got 60 oak trees on 2 acres.
Again, yeah, this is going to do a much better job with a lot less effort and for a lot less money. It's gotten to where pecan growers, you know, we release them a little later for the little pecan nutcase bearers, but pecan growers almost totally stopped spraying since they've learned what a good job the little trichogramma do. So good nurseries will have them in stock. They're probably keeping them in the refrigerator. And like I say, they're not expensive, and they will do the job, but they need to go out soon for that particular little caterpillar.
I was going to add, is the timing like a week from now or 2 weeks from now or now?
Today. Uh-huh. And I would say in the next week, but with the weather the way it is, those eggs are going to be hatching soon, so do it just as soon as you possibly can. Call around. I think most good nurseries will have them in stock.
Okay. This time of year always catches me by surprise. It's the middle of February, and it can be really cold, but it's time to get all your seeds started, and I might almost make it this year.
Well, good luck on that. Yeah, I went to bed thinking, boy, it's really warm. I'm going to wear shorts tomorrow. Got up and put on my shorts, walked outside and thought, gee, it's pretty chilly. Got in my car. It was 41 degrees this morning, but it's going to warm up and be in the 70s this afternoon. So it's a day for layers, but boy, it's going to be a beautiful day to be outside and enjoying.
Well, I sure would like to get some sugar snap peas started, but my beds aren't ready yet. You can't transplant those, can you?
Not well. Yeah. Just even if you don't do all of your beds, just get one little patch of dirt ready. If you're going to plant the bush form as opposed to the vines, you don't even have to worry about trellises or fences or anything. Just get your little triangular trowel out there or little hoe and just open up a furrow and get those seeds soaked and planted today.
Okie dokie. Well, I might have to go with a really big pot.
That'll work.
Yeah.
That'll work.
I have already started digging out my Maltese star thistle. Those rosettes are coming right along. They're about the same size as all the blue bonnets.
Yeah.
I don't want to take up too much time, but do you have any growing tips for a sweet almond verbena? I don't know how big they get.
They will get
the west side that gets really hot in the afternoon, but it's
and they'll love it. They'll love it. It'll grow 6, 8, maybe even 10 feet tall. We had one that was cold hardy and let it get away from us. We had taken some cuttings, but I don't know who they all got sold to. Most of the time, your sweet almond verbena is going to freeze back to the ground, but if you mulch it, it'll always come back out. But expect it to grow at least 4 feet tall, maybe even as tall as 6 or 8 feet. Incredible fragrance, just a really pretty plant, certainly worth having. But again, lots of sun and give it some room because it's going to make either a big bush or a small tree, depending on how you look at it.
So plant it 10 or 12 feet away from my mountain laurel?
I'd plant it at least 6 feet away from your mountain laurel.
Right. Okay. Well, hopefully the deer won't eat it. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for the call. We'll talk again. And let me see here. Yep, I guess we better get a break out of the way. Then it'll be Donna and Ron. Greg, I don't have a live here. Let's run those recordings and get back to the phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Beautiful day, and boy, what a lot of fun. Great, great questions this morning. Lots of thought-provoking things. And getting close to our visit with Howard Garrett. No, we'll have time to talk to Donna and Ron, maybe one more after that. We start with Donna. Good morning, Donna.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a Japanese maple that is about 15 years old, 15 feet tall. And this, just recently, the trunk has split from the ground to about halfway up that tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked this morning, and the bark and everything is peeling off around it. So,
And how did the tree look when it drops its leaves last fall? Did it seem vigorous and healthy?
Yes, as vigorous and healthy as a Japanese maple can look in South Texas, but But, yeah, it had leaves and everything, and I just asked my husband to look at it, and it's not coming out yet.
Oh, no. So, ours at the nursery, I don't think any of them are starting to leaf out yet. And that's normally not a problem. Japanese maple is one of those trees that when it gets moisture, like we certainly have had a bit of more than usual, sometimes it's just, you know, as my mother would have said, it's splitting its britches. It's just growing faster than the trunk can stretch. And the secret will be to watch right where that split is. And I would imagine that within the next 6 to 8 weeks, you're going to see a sort of a callus tissue form, which will ultimately completely cover that split up. You know, on pecans, pecan growers frequently will take a, you know, short-bladed knife, like a sheetrock knife or something, and they will split the bark intentionally, vertically up and down the trunk, because it allows the trunk to grow more quickly in diameter. So, if you've got, you know, just a split just going down one side of the tree, chances are it's nothing to worry about, and it may be the sign of just a healthy, vigorously growing tree. So, I wouldn't worry. Now, it'll be very telling if new growth comes out here in 3 or 4 weeks when the maples leaf out. I'll tell you, you have absolutely nothing to worry about. I'm looking out the back window here at a dead hackberry tree on the neighboring property to us that has lots of splits, but that tree was unhealthy to begin with, and it's just now that it's starting to decompose their big splits, and I hope the tree trimmer gets out here quickly and takes care of it. But what you're describing would not cause many cause for concern, and just we can talk again as the leaf buds start to come out, but from what you've told me, I think it's probably just a vigorously growing tree. As vigorous as you say, as vigorous as a Japanese maple ever gets in our area.
Okay. Okay, one more question. And I know I've heard you say this 100 times. A fast-growing shade tree.
Mexican sycamore. Fastest-growing shade tree out there, yeah. It'll make a 30, 40-foot tree in 5 years. It's okay. The two negatives, you'll have to give it some supplemental water if we get into really dry weather. You'll notice in nature they always grow along creek beds and river beds. So if we have a droughty year, they will want, you know, they'll want some supplemental water. They are a little messy, but not too bad. And they're not quite as long-lived, but they're probably going to live 50, 60 years, which is as much as we can expect out of most everything except pecans and oaks.
Okay. Okay. All right. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Donna. Thank you for the call. And next up will be Ron. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Bob. I just had to call in the guy who has the Mustang grapes.
Yeah.
My ancestors on one side were German farmers around Goliad.
Uh-huh.
And there are lots of big live oak trees there that have the vines that grow up them.
Right.
And my brother lives north of Goliad.
Uh-huh.
And here's what I want this guy to know. You can make what's called a green grape pie. It's very mm-hmm. tart. You mm-hmm. pick the grapes when they're the size of a little bitty green pea.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't let them get seeds or uh-huh. grown seeds. And then it takes 2 cups of grapes, 1 cup of sugar, an egg, 2 tablespoons of flour, a little vanilla, a pinch of salt, a half a cup of half and half, and you bake that at 350 for an hour and a half. And my grandsons who live here in San Antonio love it. It's very seasonal because the grapes are only that way for just a few days or at the most a few weeks in the spring.
Wow.
But you can make a pie out of them.
Well, I couldn't write that fast, but I can probably find a recipe somewhere. But, no, that's fun to know. I grew up spending summers with my grandparents, and my grandfather lived in Dallas, but they had a little farm down in East Texas. And my cousin and I, we thought it was great fun. We had them growing up, and I don't even remember what kind of trees they were in. But we'd physically climb 10, 12, 15 feet up that mass of grapes on the side of the tree to get up there and pick buckets full of grapes to pass back down. And my grandfather would make and can grape juice, and there was no There's no alcohol in the family, so God, grape juice, grape jelly. My former mentor and friend used to make some of the best wine I've ever had. I actually judged a couple of years the home wine division of the Medina County Fair, and both years I think we judged the best wine over there to be Mustang grape. So there are a lot of things you can do with them, but now you've just added one more fun thing to do with them before they get up big enough to be super tart, and to get them before the birds get to them. I don't suppose you'd know if that will work as well with the Black Spanish and some of the other native grapes that we sometimes have growing out there.
I'm not familiar with those. I'm not really sure. And talking about what to do with them once they're ripe, my uncle, who's now deceased, he grew up on this farm, and is German. I said, well, I guess y'all made beer. He said, oh, no, beer, we couldn't keep beer very long and spoil it. We made wine.
Mm-hmm.
From the green, from the Mustang grapes, I made wine.
An old Deutsche tradition. And das ist sehr gut. But it's they are, you know, I sometimes get a little concerned because they do get so thick sometimes that I think they do some damage shading the tree out. But, you know, having a few of them around and thinning them out if they get that thick, just for the wildlife, it's and you don't always look up in the tree when you're out walking through the woods and you look on the ground and there's squash grapes everywhere. You look up and sometimes you can have quite a harvest at certain season in the summer.
Yeah, my brother actually has to get on a ladder to pick a lot of them because they are up high. He doesn't climb the tree because he's up in his late 70s and has a bad hip. So he has to get on a ladder to pick them. But, yeah, anyway, I just thought this guy that's got the grapes, you got to pick them when they're very small, like a small green pea.
Yep.
And they make a great pie. I mean, it's very tart. It's kind of like rhubarb or something, but it's very good.
Well, I appreciate you sharing this. Is this the Ron that's moved up to Branson now, or are you – you up in that part of the world?
No, I'm the Ron who has the ranch out in Real County. I'm calling last week about the medicine wheel there at the Cornet Word property.
Right. Very good, Ron. Well, listen, it is always a pleasure hearing from you, and I'll look forward to a green grape pie one of these days.
I can stop by the nursery and drop off the recipe because I know you don't meet it. That's not the purpose of your show, is to give out recipes.
Well, I always enjoy doing it. If you're over this way, we would love to hear from you. We'll be talking to Howard Garrett right after the news break. You're listening to KTSA Radio in San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening. Actually, it's listen to Bob and Howard now. We'll go back to taking calls about the last half hour or so of the show. It's a gorgeous morning across South Texas. What does it look like in North Texas, Mr. Garrett?
Pretty perfect up here, I would say. And the plants are leafing out. I'm staring at my greenhouse, and I need to take the extra plastic off of it today. It's getting too hot.
Yep, it's a lot of things down here are starting to leaf out. Of course, the ash trees and things like that. And we're seeing swelling buds, but it's a lot of things haven't started yet. But boy, we're right on the verge. And I think both places looks like we're going to have a week or 10 days of weather in the 70s and even 80s. So it'll come on in a hurry now.
Yeah, things are peeking out of the ground. I'm seeing the inland sea oats already coming up, and several other perennials starting to bloom. The salvia in the backyard starting to grow. So the plants act like they know something.
Well, I hope they're right this time around. It's still a little chilly. I was expecting it warm when I walked out of the house a little before 4 this morning, and it was 41 degrees at home, but it was middle 50s by the time I got into town. I think we're supposed to be up around 75 this afternoon. So it's soil's still pretty cool. There's a lot of things that haven't really started coming out, but boy, I tell you, other ones have. little patillas. The ground orchids are just leafing out everywhere. Some of the ornamental oxalis is in full bloom. It's just turning into a spring-like weather and a spring-like landscape. It's
free time.
Yep. A couple of interesting questions this morning that I wanted to ask you about. And one of them has had a caller that noticed around where he has the harvester ants. And I have harvester ants out of my field, not a huge number of them, and I don't really object to them. They don't eat green foliage. They always have a little bare area around where they, have their multiple entrances usually that go down in. But he was saying that he noticed everywhere that, and this is down in the sand country south, that everywhere he had a colony of harvester ants, that the grass immediately around it was brilliant green, more so than surrounding areas. Have you ever seen that or heard about that?
Well, I've never noticed that specifically. I've noticed the greening around fire ant mounds. I pointed that out to Judy the other day. We were driving down south, and the situation there is that they're aerating the soil, bringing soil up. And if you pull up some of it in your hand, it's just beautiful soil. And they aerate the heck out of it. All kind of.
Just be sure you don't get a handful of fire ants while you're doing that. But
The harvester ants are a different matter. You know, they're primarily collecting seed, taking seed down into the colony, and then they create that bare area on the top with all their activity. But they're probably throwing out the husks and all of seed. I know they are up top, and maybe the waste of the ants may be causing part of that, but it's strange because they're really not aerating the area as much as the fire ants are, so it is kind of a head scratcher. I think it's probably because of the residue that they throw out around the entrance that's creating some kind of a, may act like hydrogen peroxide, start loosening the soil. You know, it stays bare pretty much forever if you leave the harvester ants there. The only way I've told people to control them if they're in an area where they're a problem is to put mulch over the top of the area. It just kind of makes them mad, and they tend to move the entrance to another location. But,
well,
you know, it's the waste, it's the aeration, it's the sloughing off of debris from the millions of ants that are traveling in and out that area, I guess, is what's causing that situation.
Well, it's one of those little curiosities. I leave them alone because they're such an important food source, especially for small reptiles, the lizards, the horned toads, big and very important food source for them. So, and I happen to like that little group of critters pretty well. But Roberta and I saw something really interesting this week and got a couple of pictures of it. I've got to see whose are better and send you for potential use somewhere. But she's got just right at the edge of driveway, has had a colony of them for years. Never really big, but and you know, when it rains a lot, the entrance to their mound gets all plugged up, and then pretty soon they're clearing it out. But if you look right on the top, imagine something the size of a saucer, probably 6-7 inches in diameter, and it was just a wriggling mass of ants, many of which were developing weeds. There must have been, I would say easily 60 to 100 ants, maybe even more. But obviously getting ready to have a massive flight, I presume, of both the females and the males. But I'd never seen that, just right on top of the opening. And maybe I'll send you the picture that I took in just a minute. But it was just something interesting and kind of reminded me I've seen termite swarms and things like that, just seen them coming out of a hole in the wood or whatever. But this was just right on top of the ground and just most interesting.
Yeah. Well, about all that activity, and there's a lot of activity that just goes on constantly there. I'm sure that during that activity there's organic material that's sloughed off of the ants themselves,
mm-hmm.
and the seed that they're dealing with and all, and that's probably building up and creating biological activity that is stimulating that green growth. I think that's probably the answer there.
It sounds very reasonable to me. It's just, I love it when you see something new that you've just never seen before, but just an interesting phenomenon. One other thing that I was not aware of, had a caller very early this morning told me that they're doing GMO tomatoes now, that Monsanto, I guess, is probably the principal one, and whatever seed company they're doing is offering something called the Purple Galaxy tomato, and it's once again just something to avoid out there. Everybody's planting tomatoes right now, but I just still think that the GMO is just a problem waiting to happen, and you always hate to hear about
it. A lot of these big money people that are putting money into that whole industry, like Bill Gates, I think that they're really wasting their time on the wrong stuff with all that, the rice, the golden rice, or whatever they call it. Mm-hmm. And I'll bet you if you track this tomato back, it's going to have similar links to that. The thought process is always how to make something bigger and more volume rather than how to improve the quality of it, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I don't, some of these things are done for, like you say, size and color and cosmetic things. Don't know if they have the same issues, but there's been a lot of very definitive research on these ones where they're, building in some sort of toxin or something like they're doing in the corn and some of the other things, and been shown to be very bad, disrupting a lot of reproductive process in mammals. Of course, rats are the principal thing that they test with or on, and much reduced litter sizes, much lower health rates and things like that. And I'm just a big believer that keep GMOs out of your diet as far as you can.
I totally agree. That's scary that it's still being pushed as much as it is.
Yep. Well, what's going on in your world? Go ahead.
Oh, I just said we'll keep up the vigil.
Yeah. Anything special going on in your world that we get to learn about this morning?
Oh, not too much. I've planted a bunch. Judy's got a party or two coming up here that she wanted some a little bit of improvement in the landscape. I tend to work on experimental stuff rather than making it look finalized and pretty. So I've been planting a lot of stuff and having some fun kind of experiments with the bunny rabbits. I've got a lot of pansies planted, mm-hmm. and some other things. And the first day I had them out, that first night the bunnies came in and did a number on them, and I then started dusting with just a real light dusting of a blood meal,
mm-hmm.
and I haven't had a single flower damaged since, so I'm pretty impressed with how well that's working. We've got another situation where the rats are coming in, apparently rats or mice, coming in and getting on her engine. I may have mentioned that to you before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I got some of that hot pepper, that cold hot pepper that
uh-huh.
you talked about, and mixing it with water and just spraying the underneath the car,
uh-huh.
plus putting out some other things that have a nice strong fragrance, like mustard and garlic and when you put out the garlic, for example, under the car mixed with some of the hot pepper and all, and there's any moisture at all, if you kind of lightly hose it, it hardens and stays there for a long time, especially in our situation because we've got the cars under a carport and they don't get rained on. So
uh-huh.
I think we're going to be able to set up a situation actually under the cars that are going to keep the beasts away. So far, it seems to be working. I want to treat inside the under the hood also, but I'm a little bit worried about, you know, putting stuff in there and it causing a problem for the engine or whatever. So I'm trying first just to have it under the cars.
Well, that'll be interesting. We'll look forward to hearing about that. It could certainly create a problem for the mechanic. I don't know about the engine, but that stuff is, as you've probably discovered, you better wash your hands really thoroughly after you've done anything that's got any on your skin, because boy, you dab at your eyes or any other sensitive tissue unintentionally, you'll know how hot it is very quickly.
But it seems to be a good tool. It was pretty easy to find. The stores that sell bird seed apparently are carrying it out there across the board, at mm-hmm. least to some degree. It ain't inexpensive. It's a pricey product.
Right.
I think any kind of hot pepper, you can find the cheapest ground garlic that you can get your hands on, and anything that has a real strong fragrance like that. Will help repel, and if it's a little different each time you do it or every once in a while change the formula you're using, I think it works even better.
Yeah. Well, it is pricey, but it goes a long way. You can dilute it down pretty far and still get a pretty good effect. And for people that don't want to grind up their own garlic, and, of course, garlic's one of those things that's so easy to grow, but we get two products from a company called Garlic Research Labs. They call one of them Garlic Barrier and call the other Mosquito Barrier. And that can be combined with something like the Kohl's Hot Oil to create literally a garlic pepper tea. I don't know how it will compare. I talked to Chris up at Maestro just yesterday, as a matter of fact, and I've got to ask them if there's any chance. I know it was regulatory issues that caused them to stop making the garlic pepper tea, but it would be nice to know exactly how they did it so that people could make their own if they're not going to be allowed to produce it commercially. But I'll see if we can get any more information from him next time we talk. They still do. We still buy a lot of product from them, and just good people.
Well, theoretically, he was using my formula, you know, two of the hottest peppers you can find and two bulbs of garlic. Mm-hmm. Make that into a gallon, which is your concentrate, and then use, you know, anywhere from a fourth of a cup to a half a cup of that per gallon of water for your spray. We've had really good reports about that, and one of the most interesting ones was that people used it on their trash cans when they were having problems with raccoons getting in the trash cans. And they sprayed with the garlic pepper tea formula, made themselves, and that case and sprayed it, and they said they totally eliminated the problem. It's interesting what different materials, you know, irritate the different animals. And I think, like I said, I think one of the keys is from time to time just change what you're using,
mm-hmm.
because they, no matter how irritating it is to them, they'll finally get used to it and say, I'm gonna put up with that stinky stuff because I want that good food in that trash can. So switch it up every now and then.
What are your other favorites? It's interesting. Domestic animals, for whatever reason, lavender seems to repel them. Essential oil of lavender. Dr. Kirby and I were talking about this with people trying to keep cats and dogs out of various places. What other things besides just your pepper and your garlic do you use as a repellent?
Well, that's an interesting one, lavender, because it's such a mild, pleasant fragrance. I tend to use mostly the really strong stuff, curry, pepper, mustard, garlic, of course. It works really well. Garlic is one of those things that seems to work sometimes, and sometimes they get used to it. But mixing it with other materials, I think, is a good thing to do. I bought some black pepper mixed with red pepper from Sam's or someplace. You know, I got a bigger containers I could use, and it has some really nice repelling qualities. One of my listeners gave me that tip. They were having trouble with some kind of pest coming on the porch. I don't remember if it was roaches or something. It was some kind of pest that was coming up and invading the deck and getting in the house and everything. And they used that combination, black pepper and red pepper, and totally eliminated the problem.
A fairly coarse grind or a fairly fine grind?
Yeah, it was just maybe a little bit more coarse than you using your salt and pepper shaker, you know, that kind of texture.
Well, very good. Very good. Certainly worth trying. One other thing, too, I meant to ask, and I never really thought about it, and I really should know the answer to this question, but I had always grown up thinking that grapevines were monoecious, that male and female parts on the same flower. I've had a couple of callers talking about male vines and female vines. I know that's the case with kiwis and things, but is that true of grapes, or is one grape going to produce for you? I've never seen anybody offering female or male identified as grapevines, and made me scratch my head for a minute.
No, I haven't either, and I've seen production of grapes from, you know, one vine planted. Now, I guess it could have been pollinated by another vine in the neighbor's yard or something, but no, I've never heard of that at all.
I've got to look it up after a while, and I was a little surprised, but I have seen what appear to be, you know, some vines that are much more productive than others, but I think in some case that may be culture, in some case that may be varietal, in some cases it may just be the maturity of the plant.
The biggest problem I have growing grapes is always have too shady a spot for where I'm trying to grow them. And the only one that maybe you could get away with that would be the muscadine, because a lot of times they'll be growing in a forested area. So I would imagine they can take more shade than any of the grapes.
Yeah. Well, it's just they take up so much room. They're certainly vigorous. You know, I've got some of the native, more of the Black Spanish than the Mustangs on my ranch. I know Roberta has more of the Mustangs down along her section of the river, but they're tenacious. You get one started in the garden, it'll take you a while to get rid of it. They just keep coming back when you cut them back.
Yep. That's good and bad news.
Yep. Well, we have a new member of our family that I'll send you a picture of sometime very soon. A young golden retriever named Axel became a new family member.
And, Looking forward to meeting Axel.
Yeah, he's first day he was a perfect angel. The second day he was a little bit of a devil, and today's going to be the third day, and hopefully we'll get back more to the angel side. But I tell you, there's just nothing like a puppy to brighten your life. It just brings so much joy to you. It's second only. Well, I won't even know about that. It's like being out in the garden. It just makes you smile to see it.
Well, and the goldens are the dog. I think we've talked about it before, but they're the ones that look like they're smiling and happy all the time. There's not another dog that seems as happy and enjoy being around you as a golden does. They are just fantastic.
That is very true. I'd not really thought about that, but this one still has all his puppy fur and a little bit of puppy breath, so pretty happy day around our place. And it has many parents now. Roberta and I went together to pick him up, but then like all of our dogs, he'll come to the nursery on a daily basis. This one has to be a little sequestered until we get beyond the 16 weeks so he can get his last parvo shots, but it puts a smile on your face just thinking about him.
Well, I don't know if it was Dan Kirby that said this or where I heard it, but there was a comment about a golden retriever that I thought was great, too, and that is that they're the easiest to train of all dogs. And not only that, they'll fetch a ball all day long until it's too dark for you to be out there anymore. They'll never get tired of it.
Well, I think that is true absolutely for certain about the ball. Having known a couple of very stubborn golden retrievers, I think that they are probably pretty intelligent, but and of course Roberta's had several. I've always been the guy that had the labs, but a couple of them along the way have been very stubborn, very difficult to train, and
really?
But then again, she had a couple of them at one point, and it was interesting. One of them was pretty stubborn, but the second one learned just watching. And that dog, before you put a leash or anything on and attempted to train it, pretty soon it would sit, it would stay, it would go down, it would come. And that one had never been trained, but it watched the training of, we called it sisters. They weren't really sisters, but they are super intelligent. But I'll tell you, like anything else, they can be a little stubborn. But I've never seen one climb a tree. I think Nellie still retains that title as being the special tree-climbing breed.
Yeah, she's given that up, but she's a character. She mostly spends her time chasing birds and squirrels on the ground now. That's her favorite thing. I've been laughing and watching dogs that between my house and my office. There's a lot of apartments and people, I guess every house between here and there has dogs, and I've been watching them drive. And it's so funny, and I spotted several Goldens recently hanging out the window, tongue out, having that wind blow in their face, and they could not look happier. They love that so much, it's unreal. But if you blew in their face yourself, they'd probably bite you on the nose.
I think that's a very valid observation, and I'll tell you the one thing that's even funnier than seeing that, and we have two or three customers that have it. They Dan Kirby occasionally has problems to deal with where dogs have gotten a bug in the eye hanging out the window like that. And they make something they call doggles, which are like little goggles. And you would think, you know, a dog had never put up with that. But we have two or three customers, dogs come in, and they absolutely love it. It's like this dog wearing, you know, big sunglasses, and you just can't help almost doubling up with laughter when you see a dog with its doggles on. So I don't know.
Haven't seen those yet. That's good.
Fun things, lots of fun things going on. But I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I just sent you a picture of the ants, by the way. When you look at your phone, the one's about to fly. I'll send you a picture of a puppy next, and I don't know where the time goes when we get to visit, but I'm still have plenty of things to talk about, so I think we just need to plan to do it again next Saturday morning.
We will do it. Everybody enjoy those healthy gardens in the meantime, and we'll see you all next week.
And don't forget to put a little sunscreen on if you use sunscreen. This is the kind of day when that sun will really sneak up on you. And, of course, like natural products to stop that. But don't get overheated. Drink plenty of good electrolytes. And, like you say, always enjoy the healthy gardens. And anyway, well, you guys have a wonderful week up in the Metroplex. And we'll look forward to next Saturday, Howard. And, as always, thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Bob. See you next time.
Very good. DirtDoctor.com, that's the best website on the internet with just a wealth of information out there. And if you've got a rainy day or a day that you just can't get out, sit down at your computer and just see how much you can learn in a short period of time from the Dirt Doctor, our friend Mr. Howard Garrett. Greg, I guess we better get a break in here. If anybody has a few more questions, we have time for a few more phone calls at 210-599-5555.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Looks like Judy, Victor, Brian, and Kay have all called in. That'll probably take us to the top of the hour when Mr. Mark Bamba will come in. But Judy's up first. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I'm trying to kill weeds, and I've bought my vinegar and orange oil from you, but I've lost my how you're supposed to mix it,
okay,
what the
percentages are. It's 2 ounces, or if you prefer, 2 jiggers of orange oil to a gallon of vinegar. Now, okay. I like adding a little bit of dish soap and a little bit of molasses to that, but it's a very, very effective non-selective weed killer.
Okay, and then the next question is it too early to put it down to spray?
Well, it's, you put it on green foliage only. It will act a little faster when it warms up, but overall the weather's perfect right now. You get a little faster results if you wait till this afternoon to spray, but I spray in this morning. It'll get them. You just won't see them shrivel quite as fast.
Okay, the next question is, I've got my crew coming to clean up my yard on Monday, cut down all the dead stuff. I don't really have any new stuff coming up yet. Should I wait till they cut that back to spray around the weeds around it, or can I go ahead and do that now? Will it hurt those plants if some of that hits the dead growth?
It will hurt nothing brown. But now something that has a green stem, like a rose bush or something like that, I probably would not spray it on. When I'm doing this, I carry a big piece of cardboard that I can kind of lean up against the plant and just spray around the base. But woody plant, anything that has bark on it, a tree or a mount laurel or something like that, no, as long as you don't get it on the green portion, you'll cause no problems whatsoever.
Okay, great. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You get out and enjoy your spray, and any reason to get outside on a day that's pretty is good, Judy, and I appreciate the call. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Certainly. Bye. Next in line is Victor. Good morning, Victor.
Yes, sir. I have a couple of questions, and I'll ask the questions, and I'll get off the phone. Okay, my first question is there any way that grapes, the Mustang grape or something like that, can be grafted to another grape? And the other question is, it possible, if I buried a dead possum in the back, can I plant something around it, or is that good to plant like a year and a half ago? Is it safe to plant now around it or no?
Okay, well, listen, stay on the line in case I need to ask another question of you. As far as burying over the possum grave, plant anything you like there. It's maybe a little obnoxious, but this by now smell's going to be gone. There's no harm in planting over, above, all around, and just don't dig too deeply. The question back to the grapes, so for me would be why you would really want to graft a Mustang on something else, because grapes are most commonly propagated through cuttings, and now is the time that may not be the perfect time. Fall, it sometimes works even better, but you can take cuttings of Mustang grapes and grow a new vine, and once they get some roots down, they take off and grow so quickly that I'm not sure what you would accomplish by grafting them onto another vine, but it certainly could be done. There's nothing wrong with the idea, but I just questioned what you might be accomplishing that way.
No, it's just a question that I've had, Johnny, because when we were kids, when my dad used to work at this ranch back in Uvalde many years ago, I remember we used to help the farmer, or the rancher, he had peach trees, and we grabbed something to another. I mean, we were like 6 and 7 years old,
Oh, yeah.
I was just so intrigued of that,
Well, I'll have to say grafting peaches and plums and or budding is even more than grafting. Is certainly, in my experience, a lot easier. I've never done grape grafting, so I really don't know what the process is. I know the timing is a little bit more critical, but be interesting and a fun thing to do, and to get your kids involved. It's amazing how city kids know so little about what goes on a farm or ranch or out in the country. So anything you can do to teach and help them learn is a good thing. And I appreciate the call. Appreciate you calling in, and look forward to our next visit, Victor.
Yes, sir. Have a great day. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Greg, let's get our last break of the show done. We'll talk to Brian and Kay when we come back.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, and we'll talk to Brian and Kay momentarily. But I just have to say, listening to one of those political ads, get out and vote. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for. I will tell you I'm going to be voting against some of the people been carrying out very negative campaigns. But truly, you have no right to complain later if you don't vote now. So don't forget to do it. Early voting goes on for several more days. General election day is still a week or so off. But do your civic duty and get out and vote. It's just so, so important. Ah, back to the phone lines. Brian's up first. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, Bob, your comment just made me think of something. I'm coming from Montgomery County, but with voting, like, you change your underwear, you should vote people in and out. We need some fresh voices and some fresh thoughts in it. That's for sure.
I'll tell you how I saw it expressed one time, and I think it was I don't think this is too bad to say on the air, but it said politicians like diapers should be changed periodically and for the same reason.
Absolutely. So. I cannot agree with you more. Got another comment, Bob. You know, there was a meme I saw the other day that said people were freer when the phones had cords, and I cannot agree with that more as well. And just wanted to thank you for, you know, with your comment this morning about the ants and what you saw. I just think the pondering and wonder has been lost in this generation. It's a really sad thing, but gardening is one thing that can really kind of kickstart that. So thanks for what you're doing and teaching us knuckleheads what we need to be doing.
Well, that's you're no knucklehead, but it's a real pleasure, and it is fun to get out in the country. When I look at things like the Cibolo Nature Center and school and things like that, there are good opportunities for city dwellers to expose their kids to all those good things outside. I wish more of them did it. But, you know, I'm not a negative person. There's a lot to be positive about, children's garden programs and things like that. There's a lot of good in the world. I just wish more people would take advantage of it. And anyway, Brian, you keep on spreading your bit of sunshine around and keep gardening. And it is truly a lifetime hobby. I mean, it's one thing that you can teach young men and women. I started my grandfather's greenhouse when I was 5, and still love the things that I learned doing back then. So hopefully we can encourage more people to do that. And you get out and enjoy this beautiful day. And as Howard always says, enjoy that beautiful garden.
Well, there. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, sir. Kay, good morning. How can we help you today?
Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning.
If you have an extended yard or if you have some pasture land, mm-hmm. does it ever get too hot to put out compost?
Yes, it does. And it's not, you know, you're not going to kill anything with compost, but basically because of the ammonia gas that the compost gives off, you will get a temporary yellowing. If you put it out, you know, on a lawn or something like that, it will eventually green up again. But I don't recommend applying compost to grass once the temperature really starts getting up in the 80s. Now, there's never a bad time to put it out as a mulch on the surface or to work it in. I frequently, you know, compost itself makes a good mulch. It's just and compost is just sort of a well decomposed mulch, so there's never a bad time to do that on bare soil, on beds around plants, around vegetables, things like that. I would never put it up right against the trunk of, say, tomatoes or peppers or that sort of thing. But it's a great question, and yes, it does very definitely get too hot to be an ideal time to put it out. Like I say, it's not going to kill your grass, but it will cause some temporary yellowing. And it's a little bit wasteful because that ammonia gas that's given off in the heat, if you put your compost out and water it down, it actually becomes a liquid fertilizer that you know, will benefit your grass. When you're losing the ammonia gas, you're losing a lot of nitrogen that would be of benefit going into the soil. And that's not as much of an issue when the weather's a little cooler. So, good question.
How hot can it get before you can't put it out anymore?
I
I'm not talking about a garden. I'm talking about just out.
Well, again, just out, you can do it pretty much any time. But if you were putting it directly on grass, I would not do it once the temperature gets up into the 80s. Just putting it out on bare soil or anything, no. It's you can do that at any temperature. Like I say, you lose a little bit of the benefit of the compost because some of those materials will be volatilized and lost up into the air. And that's probably going to happen any time above 80. But as far as hurting anything, no. As far as putting it on the surface of the ground, it's always going to keep the surface of the ground cooler, which is going to be very beneficial to the roots of most plants as we move further and further into the summer months.
Okay. I'll remember that. Thank you so much.
Well, it's always a pleasure, and I appreciate the call this morning. Anybody else out there waiting to talk, Greg? All right. Well, then I guess I'll just tell you a few things that I would recommend for this weekend. It's a great time to put out fertilizer. If you haven't fertilized in the past 90 days, get out and get some good organic fertilizer, whether it's Nature's Creation or Medina or Maestro Grow. There are many good organic fertilizers out there, many of them based on different things, and you may want to mix it up. Use different ones at different times, but the fertilizer does no good while it's in the bag or bottle. It needs to go out, and this would be a great day for it. And remember, with organic products, there is no rush to water them in, so good thing to do. Great time to start planting in the vegetable garden. There are some things that will take the cold. You can still plant some broccoli. You can certainly plant chard at this point. Get a little late on spinach. If you're going to grow any snow peas, you need to get those into the ground immediately. Now, you take your chances if you plant plants like peppers and tomatoes and eggplant. I know a lot of folks are doing it. Keep in mind that dry winds, especially cold dry winds, are very, very dehydrating to those young plants. So I strongly recommend when you plant those tomatoes, go ahead and put your cage around them. Same thing for peppers. I grow peppers in a cage as well. And then wrap that lower 18 inches or so of the cage with fabric material like the insulate is one I love, because keeping the wind off of your young transplants is going to do a great deal to prevent dehydration damage. And once again, if you plant tomatoes, I think it's just mandatory if you want the best production. Dig that hole a little bit deeper than you normally would. Put a handful of rock phosphate in the bottom. Plant your plant, your tomato plant, directly on top of it. Does not hurt for the roots to come in contact with the rock phosphate. And research has shown that you'll get about twice as many pounds of tomatoes when you do that. Also, with peppers, if you're plants are a little big, even if they're very overgrown, you can plant them more deeply into the ground. Tomatoes are the one plant that will grow roots up and down the stem. So if you've got a plant that's 8, 10 inches tall, go ahead and take off a couple of the lower leaves and maybe bury it 4 inches down in the ground. You'll end up with a stronger plant because of all the roots that will grow up and down the stem. Years ago, working with one of my mentors, we had professional tomato growers would come in that always want to buy the biggest, most overgrown plants we had. And I would say, how are you ever going to dig a hole big enough, deep enough to plant this? And I was told, well, we don't plant them in a hole. We plant them in a trench. We lay the plant down, cover it with soil, and just turn the end up out of the end of the trench. And these are folks that did it, you know, for commercial reasons and obviously knew what they were doing. So just fine to plant your tomatoes a little deeper. Wouldn't do it with peppers, wouldn't do it with eggplant, and I think it may be a little early, especially for hot peppers and eggplant. I'd suggest probably waiting another week or two before you plant those. But tomato plants, an awful lot of folks are gambling and putting them into the ground, and it's a very little expenditure, and you may get the first tomatoes in the neighborhood. So that would be a fun thing to get done outside. Flowers, again, we've got things that are totally cold hardy, like dianthus, like snapdragons. Alyssum is borderline cold hardy, and you do not have to worry about cold weather. Even if it gets quite chilly, it's not going to hurt those plants. A lot of people are planting more tender things, especially begonias. Begonias are probably the hardiest. I think it's too early for impatiens. I think it's too early for zinnias and our more tender things, but of the begonias, lots of folks putting those out. And there's just no reason to have a drab yard. Some of your colorful foliages, like Dusty Miller, oh, it's totally cold hardy. Go ahead and get that out. We'll do this again tomorrow morning, Poor Gardening from 8 till 11, followed by Your Pet's Health with Dr. Dan Kirby. Martin Bomba's next here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.